Is a preview of the future programs coming up on WGXC on Tuesday. WGXC on Tuesday, December 10th, 2019. Right after the news at 12 p.m., Overlooked, hosted by Rob Safer. Overlooked is a show focusing on overlooked and underheard jazz, improvisational, and other fringe music. This broadcast will include new pieces from Sun O, Miles Ozaki, Bill Orcutt, Tune Yard, Skouratos Sonopoulos, Spaza, The Last Poets, and more. And then at 7 p.m., The Art of the Hudson Valley, hosted by Chad Weckler. In this broadcast, a conversation with Mary Brenneman, Nancy Canna, Christy Sagster, and Amanda Taylor about the upcoming Blue Exhibition at the gallery at 46 Green Street in Hudson. To view the full programming schedule, make a one-time donation, or become a sustaining donor, visit our website, WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Michael Shimidis of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Forgotten Key here on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre Casco Hudson. This is Corey McCaslin, going to be the last installment of the year, and I'll be playing a little bit of geek-themed Christmas music, of course, some geek speak, and about towards getting closer to the bottom of the hour, but probably a little bit before that, I'll be having my friend, local resident, Frank Farrell, cult horror filmmaker, behind Spookies and Street Trash for a little interview. So, getting straight into the geek speak, the house cleaning of Marvel TV continues. The Hollywood Reporter breaking that the Chelsea Handler, produced by and starring animated series Tigra and Dazzler, has dismissed Addams Family writer Erica Rivenoja and her team from the show with a plan to retool it from the ground up. Continue with Marvel's future live-action serialized efforts at the Comic-Con Experience and Cosplay event in Cologne, France. Kevin Feige announced the second wave of Disney Plus shows. She-Hulk, Ms. Marvel, and Moon Knight are expected to air in late 2020. Bit of a surprise to me. I figured Ms. Marvel would come closer to the Captain Marvel sequel, which, if I recall correctly, is slated for 2022. Here comes the inevitable expansion of the Disney live-action remake universe. Heat Vision reports Billy Magnuson will reprise his role as failed suitor Prince Anders from Aladdin in a Disney Plus series. Disney's also not going to leave no stone unturned on the Planet of the Apes. Deadline reporting Maze Runner director Wes Bell will continue the series, though whether that'll be directly on from the recent Caesar-focused trilogy or another reboot remains to be seen. Another revived franchise is delaying a newer one. As Lance Reddick told comicbook.com, filming of a fourth John Wick will likely be delayed due to Keanu's commitment to Matrix and press touring for Bill and Ted 3. On the heels of the Wonder Woman 1984 trailer, hashtag Forgotten Geekgasm, Pedro Pascal as Maxwell Lord, Cinepop is claiming Cinepop broke that Patty Jenkins is developing a spinoff focusing on the Amazons, which the director herself confirmed the next day. For this installment of What Are They Turning Into a Cinematic Universe Now?, Deadline reports Walking Dead production company Circle of Confusion has picked up A Wicked Tale, a modernization of Hansel and Gretel, with plans to launch a Grimm's Fairy Tale-verse from it. Michael Moorcox, Elric, come on down. You're next in this week's This Platform Needs a Game of Thrones. The classic 11-book multiverse-spanning fantasy horror series is being developed by New Republic Pictures as a multi-format franchise, starting with a streaming series as their first priority. So, getting into some music. Here are the Go-Go's, not that Go-Go's. This was a one-off novelty Go-Go's with I'm Going to Spend My Christmas with a Dalek. And I should clarify that BBC confirmed once and for all Doctor Who returns on January 1st, not December 25th. All right.
I bring you greetings from all Daleks.
I'm gonna spend my Christmas with a Dalek and hug him underneath the mistletoe. I'll feed him sugar spice and hang a Christmas stocking from his big lead toe. And when we both get up on Christmas morning, I'll kiss him on his chrome-inflated head and take him in to say hi to Mom and frighten Daddy out of his bed. Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Happy Christmas!
Happy Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
I wish to be your friend. Please may I have some more plum pudding and custard.
I'm gonna spend my Christmas with a Dalek, and if I make him happy, he will stay. Christmas,
Christmas tree,
Happy Christmas,
mistletoe,
Merry Christmas,
Merry Christmas
to you. Merry Christmas,
I love you.
Happy Christmas,
you love me.
Merry Christmas,
Merry Christmas
to you. Merry Christmas!
More black pudding!
Happy
Christmas! More cups! Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
There's an old man on a sleigh who's like me, just for one day, bestrides the world like a huge colostomy. He gets no presents, he gets no fun, and he's forgotten when he's done. So here's a little gift, a song to him from me. Merry, 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 merry Christmas, Santa Claus. Merry Christmas, Santa Claus. Merry Christmas, you're a lovely guy. So let's
let us recall what started it all on that Bethlehem night so long ago. When people gazed from afar upon a giant star, which reminds me of someone you all know. Jesus in that manger lay, while the sheep and donkeys swayed, and the wise men and shepherds bowed their heads. Jesus heard the lullaby, so he opened up his eyes, then looked up at his mummy and said, Merry Christmas, Santa Claus! Merry Christmas, Santa Claus! Merry Christmas, you're a lovely guy! Merry Christmas, Santa Claus! Merry Christmas, Santa Claus! Merry Christmas, you're a lovely guy!
Dear Santa, you know, words don't come easy to me, but I just want to say, from the top of your Christmas stocking to the bottom of your Christmas bottom,
I have a dream today, my friends, that before this Christmas ends, a big Santa's sack of love I'll bring. Then we'll unite the whole crew. Yes, even Belzins too. And we'll all stand together and sing. Santa Claus, Merry Christmas, Santa Claus, Merry Christmas, you're a lovely guy. Merry Christmas, Santa Claus. Merry Christmas, you're a lovely guy. Merry Christmas, Santa Claus. Merry Christmas, Santa Claus. Merry Christmas, you're such a lovely guy. Merry Christmas, Santa Claus. Merry Christmas, just because. Merry Christmas, you're a lovely fat but nice and lovely guy.
Okay, that set started with Go-Go's, different Go-Go's, doing I'm Gonna Spend My Christmas with a Dalek, and then you heard Max Headroom with Merry Christmas, Santa Claus. Now, the Nick Cage-assance is in full swing with two new projects. Deadline reports he signed on for Wally's Wonderland, where he'll play a janitor trapped overnight in an amusement park where the animatronics have possibly gone bad. Meanwhile, that awkward moment, director Tom Gormican will go meta with The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, which sees a fictionalized Cage recruited by the CIA to get intel on a billionaire fan-slash-drug lord who then complicates matters by trying to reconcile him with his ex-wife and teen daughter. One of the more notable zombie movies to rise above the horde was 2016's Korean Zombies on a Train, Train to Busan. Back in August, a sequel was confirmed, and Hallyu Life just announced that August 2020 will see the release of Peninsula, which will switch to a new perspective on the events of the original film. With your goosebumps and your fear streets already taken, Variety reports that John M. Chu and HBO Max have picked deeper into the R.L. Stine catalog. The Crazy Rich Asians Helmer will adapt the Master of 90s U-Flit Horrors series Point Horror. Another Crazy Rich alum going deeper in the genre is Awkwafina, as in addition to roles in Little Mermaid and Shang-Chi, Variety reports she signed on to Legendary's adaptation of A. Lee Martinez's Constant Verity series, which follows a young woman who's been chosen wanting it since she was born and longs for a normal life. short-form platform Quibi's reinvention of The Fugitive has some competition, as Warner's has assigned Albert Hughes to re-spin the original tale of Richard Kimball going on the lam into a new film. The star of the last successful spin of The Fugitive is going streaming like his contemporary Pacino. Variety broke that Harrison Ford will produce and star in an adaptation of The Staircase, the 2004/2018 documentary series that explored the spousal murder case against novelist Michael Peterson. Following up rumors from recent installments, Joel Hodgson took to Kickstarter mailing list to confirm that Netflix is now the third network/platform to cancel MST3K. But as he said, this ain't the Cowtown Puppet Show's first cancellation rodeo, and it probably won't be gone for as long this time, especially with Jim Mallon out of the way. Naturally, some fans, yours truly included, are having some schadenfreude at reports today that Netflix has lost subscribers over this year for the first time since 2011. Maybe people are catching on to how they cancel 90% of their shows after two or three seasons. A sketchy rumor from a very good source is a comment by Danny Elfman in a recent interview. He's heard The Simpsons is getting close to ending, though I doubt it would be this season, like he said, since they probably went into production at least one more season. A VOD launch announcement number 345. Engadget announced that Plex, they of media library management software, is trying to stand out in the field by launching a free ad-based service. Under the free-to-watch category on their site is access to movies, TV shows, docs, and Bollywood, with content providers including Warner's, MGM, and Lionsgate. Deadline reports producer Graham King will follow up on Bohemian Rhapsody with another musical twofer, negotiating rights with the respective estates for Bee Gees and Michael Jackson biopics. Over to a subject that wore more makeup than your average glam rocker, Michael Showalter's adaptation of the doc The Eyes of Tammy Faye, starring Jessica Chastain and Andrew Garfield as the titular and her televangelist husband, has gained Vincent D'Onofrio as other Rogues Gallery member Jerry Falwell. Now we'll go into another quick little set before I bring in Mr. Frank Farrell. And here is James Covenant with Captain Picard singing Let It Snow.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go,
make it so.
Make it so. Make it so. Man,
it doesn't show signs
of stopping.
And I brought me some tea, oh, very hot.
The lights turn way down low.
Make it so. Make it so. Make it so.
When we finally kiss.
Good night.
Now, I hate going out
in the storm. But if you...
Really?
Shut up, Wesley.
All the way home, I'll be...
Warm. Oh, the fire is slowly dying. And my dear...
We're still goodbye, then.
But as long as you love me,
so
make it so.
Make it so.
Make it so.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to The Satellite. As a special treat, Crow, Tom, and I have written and are going to perform an original Christmas carol.
Mike, it's not just for Christmas. It's for holidays of all faiths.
Yeah, right. Don't call it a carol, because no. Carol is a woman's name, and we want this song to be all-inclusive.
Right. Why don't you hit a camera? There we go.
Let us all now sing our praises to the Lord today. Although you may not share our belief system, which is perfectly okay.
Maybe you worship an abstract being that is kind of vague. Or maybe you just worship a guy whose name is Greg.
Perhaps your religion doesn't include a time called Lent, but whatever your religion is, we support you 100%.
So sit around the fire and have a chestnut roast, or raise a glass in toast to happy days Donnymost.
But if you prefer to eat Indian food on Christmas Day, I can only shrug my shoulders and say no. Namaste, namaste.
Personally, I prefer turkey, gravy, and salad. But let's never forget, all cultures are valid.
So let's have peace on earth and cut out all the bull. Let's have a holiday reason that's multicultural.
If there's one point we'd like to make with this festive holiday song,
it's that Christmas comes just once a year, so for a few days, for crying out loud, can we all just get along?
Okay, and that set started with Captain Picard singing Let It Snow by James Covenant. And you just heard Best Brains, a.k.a. the people behind Mystery Science Theater 3000 with Merry Christmas, if that's okay. So, now we will start our interview portion, always an exciting prospect for me. With and now let me introduce cult horror filmmaker and local resident Frank Farrell, whose most famous film, horror comedy The Spookies, was just released with deluxe limited edition Blu-ray treatment by Vinegar Syndrome. He was also in the director's chair for 1987's New York City at its sleaziest set, horror comedy Street Trash, and several other things. So how are you doing today, Frank?
I'm doing great, actually. And you said that Spookies was the film I'm most famous for. I would think Street Trash is more famous. But with what's going on with Spookies, that could change.
Yeah, because of course, you know, I saw Street Trash first. So that part would be a more accurate statement. But yeah, the recent re-release, I'd say, you know, Spookies is on everybody's minds a lot, especially yours. And I guess my first question is, what made you want to be a filmmaker? How'd you get into it?
From a fairly young age, I think I had an interest and a fascination with movies, maybe beyond the average kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, growing up at a time, there were still like regular weekly kiddie matinees in movie theaters. So I like went to the movies every Saturday, and I was very into it. And they would at that time they would still they would frequently just bring back older pictures.
Yeah,
they would bring this is like the '60s, and they would bring back '50s horror movies and things I saw the Three Stooges at one of the shows.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, because I remember that kind of trailed off in the early '80s. But I know I saw at least one that was kind of like that. I always say I prefer to say that Return of the Jedi was the first movie I remember seeing in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
But it might have been a kiddie matinee for the love of Benji.
Right. I think the first movie I ever saw in a theater was Disney's Pinocchio in a re-release when I was about 4.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, actually, For the Love of Benji is actually pretty interesting for a Benji movie, kind of like a spy thriller that has Benji thrown into it. Definitely made an impression on me. So, listeners may have seen you in front of the camera as well as a zombie on the original Dawn of the Dead, as well as Rescue from Obscurity by Troma, Slasher, Igor, and the Lunatics, both of which are favorites of mine in very different ways.
Although I worked on Igor and the Lunatics for a few weeks as a production manager.
Okay.
Because my partners, who I later did Spookies with, had sort of wandered into the set after finding out about the production going on, and within like a few weeks they were, they said, "Hey, is this a horror movie you're making?" And they said, "Yeah, we think we think it's a sophisticated thriller." and he said, "Well, it seems to be Brendan and Tom, my partners, it seems to be a horror movie, but you have no horror in it."
Yeah.
So they have a separate directorial credit for horror and action scenes,
mm-hmm.
which, if I were the other director getting the standard credit, I would be like reluctant to let somebody have that credit on my movie.
I know. You got any stories about Dawn of the Dead?
Dawn of the Dead, let's see. We found out about Dawn being shot at the Monroeville Mall in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, we heard about it. Brendan and I said, "Well, let's go." And it was unfortunately the day of a raging blizzard, like maybe the worst I can remember actually driving in.
Oh, wow.
And we took a 12-hour trip in couldn't see like 10 feet in front of us. And we got there, and what was great, we got there and we were like, even though we were just sort of spontaneously showing up, I actually did an interview with George I think I just actually interviewed George, that was later published in a magazine, but they were very kind, receptive. I mean, they like immediately like were cooperative. I was handed a copy of the screenplay, and we wound up playing two fairly like easy to spot zombies in the movie during the climactic scenes. The famous makeup artist Tom Savini is out there, and he's like playing a biker, leader of a bike gang, and he's ravaging the countryside. And at this point, they're just having fun with the zombies, and he's running around the mall. His friends are hitting the zombies in the face with pies.
Yeah.
And so my partner, Brendan, gets a close-up shot in the face with a pie, and I'm what I refer to as the seltzer zombie, that Savini had a spray bottle of seltzer and hits me in the face with it.
Oh, yeah, totally remember those.
You know, so that, I mean, that was terrific on its own. I mean, I had no idea at the time. George was just sort of shooting more stuff. He had some time and he had some money. Mm-hmm. He thought he had enough to make the complete film, but he was just coming up with ideas and then acting on impulse and shooting. Yeah. And I was surprised that, like, most of what I was there for that day did wind up in the picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, like, I remember reading Zombies Today Pittsburgh, and it was talking about, you know, all the people coming in to, you know, audition to play zombies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and, you know, it's there were, you know, like, dozens of other people there. I mean, it's... You know, and I presume most of them were locals, but I got the feeling like a lot of people were hearing about it and coming from various parts of the country too.
Yeah.
You know, but that that was a very positive experience.
Oh yeah.
And the picture later, I mean, I was a big fan of Night of the Living Dead. Mm-hmm. Prior to this, I had in high school, I had a film club, and that was the first movie we showed. Which at the time, this is like the early 70s, mid 70s, it was like kind of, you know, it has nudity and extreme gore. And it was kind of like, you know, like, should we be showing this at a high school? and the great thing, and I'll never forget this, is that I guess apparently, like, the average high school student at that time was not used to seeing a very gory type of horror movie. There's like the first scene where there's like an explosion and a truck blows up and the zombies pull out the people who died inside and start eating them. Mm-hmm. And it's fairly explicit. You know, there are people like munching on limbs and livers and things. I'm standing outside the auditorium at this moment, and somebody comes out and walks past me and rushes over and vomits into a garbage can.
Oh, wow.
Right. This was followed by somebody coming out about every 2 or 3 minutes after the rest of the movie and doing this.
And, of course, by today's standards, it's tame. I mean, the first zombie movie I ever saw was Return of the Living Dead.
So, well, that's, yeah, that's like a world away. I mean, you know, that's, you know, by that time, you know, a gory movie was like, you know, a standard kiddie movie.
Yeah. So, the making or unmaking of the Spookies, or as you and your partners originally tended to call it, Twisted Souls, was mm-hmm. enough to fill up a feature-length documentary on the Blu-ray. Can you care to summarize it? Going to or
sure. They well, we were approached by two guys that we sort of knew because one was Michael Gingold, who was for a long time the editor of Fangoria. He's now, I mean, his stuff is all over the web. He basically travels around the country, watching movies and going to events and sharing his knowledge with fans of horror and science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And his partner, Glenn Baisley, was the guy who was involved with one of the first theatrical revivals of Spookies as part of the Hudson Horror Show. And it was shown at the Alamo Theater in Yonkers, downstate from here. And unfortunately, myself, my two partners, heard about it late and were unable to get there. And I actually, at the time, I was ill. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I had already moved up here, I think. No, was that, maybe that was before I moved up here. But I couldn't go. My partners, Tom and Brendan, couldn't go. A few people, like some actors, did manage to get there and did talk to the audience. And it was extremely well received. And it had, from what we found out, the Alamo, which is a, you know, a chain that spans the country, they show all the current hits, but they also, like, will do revivals. They'll do art films. Mm-hmm. They're really a movie fans theater.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they actually care about people who care about movies.
Yeah, I'm always hearing about, you know, the great screenings going on there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, just the other stuff they had, like, you know, coming up. Like, I wanted to, you know, camp out there for a few weeks.
Yeah.
When I finally got to a screening at one of the theaters. So we heard about this, and then we would hear about, like, every few months there would be a screening in Texas or somewhere, and we'd be like, all right, well, why didn't somebody let us know at least? You know, they probably would like to have us there. You know, and we would actually like to see an audience that liked Spookies, because as some people know, including you, for a long time we've hated Spookies.
Yeah.
It's sort of the film, I guess we haven't gotten to this part yet. The film was, we finished shooting a feature film, like, which was like pretty much wall to wall monster and creature effects, and that was the idea. That's what our backer demanded of us.
Yeah, and no better water.
And we really, we did bite off more than we could chew. We promised too much because he kept wanting more, and his whole demeanor sort of made it that, you know, you feel like you were made to feel that he would say, all right, that's it, the picture's off, and I'm going elsewhere at any given moment if he wasn't told yes to what he wanted.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, we could sometimes get him to change his mind, but it was a struggle the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
So in any case, we finished the picture. We were in the middle of cutting it, and to seriously simplify it, we got into an argument in the editing room. The film was co-directed by my two partners, Tom and Brendan. And then one day, as has been revealed on the internet, with more to come in the next few weeks, I'm sorry, there's a little noise over here that's distracting me. We got into an argument which resulted in him. Let me rephrase this. Michael Lee, who financed the film, recut one of the key scenes in the film, which is the one with the spider lady, the woman who turns into an enormous spider. After Tom had spent a week or more cutting that scene, he was happy with it. It was, you know, it took a lot of work, but he got it where he wanted it, and it was a good scene. I think it would have been the best scene in the entire movie. Maybe it's arguably still is. But Michael wanted us to, you know, to keep going. And Tom, who was overworked, like all of us, became ill. He was out for about 2 weeks with flu. And Michael got impatient, and he demanded that he could that he be able to sit down with the editor and just start doing some cutting. So he recut that entire scene. Tom came in and said, "What did you do? This is like incomprehensible garbage. He just lost it." And that resulted in us sort of having to take a stand as a group and say, all right, we can't put up with this. We then were advised by our lawyer to sue him before he sued us. So we served him with papers because he still also had left roughly $30,000 or $40,000 in debt with our company, which he was refusing to pay. And so we were off the movie. And everything had to be turned over to him and his company and his people and his lawyers. And he subsequently encountered a woman who was editing a film down the hall at the editing house. And I think you know this story somewhat.
Yeah, but it should be.
She was a fairly famous porn star from the 70s and 80s. Worked under a lot of different names. I guess he went to her and asked her thoughts on what he could do to finish this movie, because we had walked out without a lot of the climax finished. We had optical effects that had to be, you know, inserted. There was literally a whole 10 or more minutes that we didn't get to complete properly. And when we wouldn't come back, when our people, he wanted, you know, originally Michael wanted all the actors and technicians to come back, and, you know, and they sided with us. So he had to go elsewhere, and he, I guess, after showing this woman the movie, he somehow was convinced to throw out half the movie so that she could shoot scenes and replace our scenes with them, meaning inserting a whole new set of characters, a different plot. From what I have heard, and I had forgotten this, but apparently according to her claims, I mean, we shot, I'd have to check, but I think we shot 12 or 13 weeks, right? I mean, that was, our schedule went over, we were too ambitious. The effects work takes a lot longer than you think, and this was our first long-term experience with that type of stuff.
Too many ideas.
Yeah, I mean, basically, even with the best technicians, these things, you know, they're not real. There's something that's going to go wrong, constantly.
Oh, yeah.
And you're trying to get a specific shot and an angle, and you've got to get the lighting. So it's tedious work, you know. But you got to get it right.
If you're even half of that, you know, you got to.
Right. So anyway, she shot, as far as I know, a total of maybe 2 weeks. Right. But that 2 weeks now has 45 minutes of footage that is.
And that's the thing. If you watch it, even if you're not an experienced viewer, you can kind of tell it's two movies mashed up, or it feels like two movies mashed up. You know, because her stuff and whoever the weird Dracula type villain have practically nothing to do with the rest of the movie, with the actual anything that looks good in that movie, you can kind of tell came from your side,
right?
I mean, well, it's especially notable at the end where she's being swarmed by zombies. And
you mean the everything but the kitchen sink ending?
Oh yeah, and it's like not to be overly concerned, but it's like wow, this is kind of this.
I mean, Michael was so
way.
Desperate for monsters, they probably could have convinced him to put in a kitchen sink.
There might have been one at some point and just missed it. And of course, my favorite. Actually, I've been meaning to ask you this. Is like there's a pretty good scene, I think, in some basement or something.
Oh,
the muck men, and it would be good, but there's like fart sounds overlaid, and I was like, what the hell?
Yeah, that was like one of the unfortunate things that happened.
Yeah.
And apparently, from what I know, there's a sequence in the movie where these creatures rise out of the earth in the basement to attack the protagonist, and there's a how can I put it? There's a whole story about having to shoot that scene where the outfits for these guys who were supposed to be playing the monsters was like basically absolutely unacceptable on the day we were shooting when it was brought to us, and we just started to panic, and then we just got other members of our makeup crew to step up and deal with it. And considering that they had to instantly come up with these things, it's like I'm pretty happy with what they came up with.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we might have done better, but there just wasn't any time.
Oh, no, yeah. I mean, the actual,
So there's that scene in the movie, and Ms. Joseph shot, new stuff, but she didn't shoot that scene. But what happened is the sound effects editor, supposedly, because he and I've chatted with him online, and he claims responsibility. In fact, he's proud of it. He overlaid farting sounds over all this, as if they're like rising up, and there's like gas coming out of them.
Yeah,
right. And this was very popular with the lowest common denominator crowd. meaning like people for years. Oh, I love the farting scene. Well, fuck you. You shouldn't be watching our movie. I'm sorry. Oh. Okay. All right. Now that we're in trouble.
Well, we get passionate sometimes. But no, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, the lowest common denominator, maybe a few sounds like that would have been okay. But, it's like.
Yeah, so we had to endure that. And for years, the film was reviewed mostly online with people making a point to mention that scene and loving it. Like the good reviews, the bad reviews. And believe me, there were lots of bad reviews.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, we went. We sort of this all served to the film that came out was not the film we made in almost any way. Except our scenes that were still there were recut from end to end. No one shot connects to another shot the way it was intended to.
Yeah, that's another thing that's very clear.
A lot of the key horror scenes, the selling point of the movie, the reason anyone even cares about this movie at this time in history, each was a few minutes long, and monster action, etc. She just chopped them. I mean, they look like they're excerpts from a trailer or something.
Yeah.
The way that they cut.
Yeah, like I said, yeah, it's one of the. I was like, even if I hadn't heard all this, you could just tell it's just such a hatchet job. It's like there's a good movie buried in there.
Well, somewhere. Mm-hmm. So, just to get back to the Muck Men, apparently Michael had a fascination with flatulence.
Yeah.
that was one of his things. And apparently the sound editor knew this. And as a joke, when they got down to like a final sound mix, he had inserted all these farting sounds, right? Jeannie
that
Joseph, who is the person, or the one of the pseudonyms of the person who was the new director, later revealed that she hated. We thought she was the instigator of this, but she later revealed that she hated this.
Mm-hmm.
However, Michael, with his fart fetish, was delighted by it and left it. Insisted that it be left in the movie.
I guess maybe if it's just been like a couple here and there, but it seems to just be constantly overlayered. And of course, this is just me. I've just never really been much into toilet humor, so.
Well, to me, it's
it's not like I'm totally opposed to it. It just has to be.
To me, it was
one
of the overall signs of desperation in what they did with it, because they were not, quite honestly, very creative people.
Yeah.
They hacked this together. She somehow brainwashed Michael Lee into thinking that the movie was terrible and unreleasable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, literally, I mean, To tell the truth, even as it is now, even if we had just had the monster scene with, like, minutes of blank footage in between, I feel it would be better than what we have.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, the scenes that were obviously shot, you know, by her just make no sense. As, you know, it's... it's hard to describe, you know.
You know, I mean, however... The fact is that the film has, over the years, and this only started with the internet, you know, because people get to communicate. And,
oh, yeah.
That people have revealed that they like or love the film.
Mm-hmm.
And bear in mind that almost every review we got was basically a bad one, mocking the film. You know, it's there are reviews all over the internet for the past 20 years saying, oh, one of the worst films ever made.
No, I would still never go.
Without understanding why it has certain problems.
The backstory, you know, it's like, no. I mean, yeah, not good to finish project.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there are still weird misimpressions that seem to get out there. I just heard this past few days that people are talking about, you know, in chats on Facebook, etc. They're claiming that, there was a climactic scene that is lost,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was not lost. What was lost is half of the movie, our half of the movie. The footage is gone, mm-hmm. to my knowledge, although I had some new news about it today. You know, who knows? The search will go on.
Yeah.
We got to a point where, I mean, we saw the movie. It's gotten so badly maligned over the years, mm-hmm. you know, and it seriously short-circuited our careers. My partner, Tom Doran, who I think was a creative genius, was so dismayed. He just felt ashamed. And I did too. There was no way to get out from under that to a great extent.
Yeah,
it's like you make a feature film, you do your first feature, and you think, oh, all right, doors will open now, people will know I can do this. It made money, you know, they'll think you can make the money.
Mm-hmm.
And we got no such reception. I mean, not every, but 9 out of 10 doors we did knock on got slammed in our faces.
Oh, I mean, especially we're considering how much the 80s were a heyday, especially, you know, I mean, just so much, you know, horror being released because it was just so cheaply made, and you had the, you know, VHS market to fill.
And yeah.
It was, you know, surprising.
Yeah, I mean, so it was like a kind of a shock to us, I think, that, you know, we did what we were supposed to do, now you're supposed to talk to us.
Yeah.
And it was still pulling teeth.
Yeah.
And it's remained that way up until this, roughly this time.
And I think there will be, you know, still, you know, it's weird because there's still enough quality in there for, like, somebody to say, okay, for their first effort, you know, needs a lot of work, let's talk, you know, at least talk to, you know, and your partners and see.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, if nothing else, everything we shot was very technically competent. We had what I think was pretty good lighting. We had, you know, the creature designs are unique. The effects people were, most of them who were just starting out in their careers, did an amazing job, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Considering that we had, like, constant problems, we never had enough of anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine for, you know, however little as may. I mean, yeah, the effect, you know, the monster effects definitely still hold up, especially nowadays when you're, you know, longing for those kind of practical effects.
Right, and it's so interesting because, like, everything is now computer graphics, most of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And going back, you know, as much as 10 years ago, people were starting to say, hey, no matter what you do to make this look realistic, we still don't quite buy it. We prefer that things be real.
Yeah, there is definitely a feel to it, and people are starting to get that. I mean, like, even Wonder Woman 1984 is mostly practical effects, you know.
Right, I've heard about, like, more and more films and TV shows nowadays are specifically avoiding CGI.
Yeah. Yeah, because it took so long for it to sink in, just how, I think maybe it just, like, took 10 years for everybody to go back, look at stuff, and realize, oh, this has not aged well. You know, it's like you look at, like, what pretty much started the, arguably the CGI revolution, Terminator 2 and mm-hmm. Jurassic Park especially, and they still look great. But
They do, and I didn't, like, have those problems with the kind of problems I have now where I see stuff. And, like, you know, something turns into CGI, and I'm, like, immediately taken out of the movie.
Within a couple years, it started getting bad, and it just kept getting worse in terms of removing you from, like you said, getting...
You know, I mean, it's now used as a convenience by everybody. It's like, you know, the standard line was, you know, you're shooting something, and you make it... Something screws up, and you say, oh, well, we'll fix it in post. And meaning used to mean the editing. Now it just means, well, we'll just draw in something different, and it'll be fine.
But you did work on one more movie after that, Street Trash. You want to talk about that?
Okay, well,
that's one I've, you know.
I, I was brought in as the production manager, line producer, on-set producer of Street Trash by Roy Frumkus, who wrote it and was the key producer. And he knew, you know, that I was doing spookies all along and invited me. You know, I'd known Roy for a number of years. I had been in his class at the School of Visual Arts previously. We were actually good friends for a long time. Spookies went by and crashed. And then I spent about a year recovering. And then we started to put things together for Street Trash. And Street Trash has actually gone on. I think Street Trash is probably one of the most popular, low-budget, so-called cult horror movies ever made.
Oh, yeah. I should remember that, because I remember, I think I found it on, bought it on VHS before I moved up here, and then it took a year or two later, and my roommate saw it, and she was like, oh, one of our friends, saying she loves this, so, let's watch it, and yeah.
And Street Trash, whereas with Spookies, I feel like, I have to live with that being a misrepresentation of what myself and my associates are capable of.
Yeah.
And I guess... we eventually had to accept it. Now we're getting vindicated to some extent. But with Street Trash, I unreservedly feel very proud about Street Trash.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's really well made.
Yeah.
I think it's really well shot. Mm-hmm. I think the characters and performances, even where some places the acting is not perfect, but the characters are always interesting and fun.
Oh, yeah.
The editing is terrific. I remember sitting there in the cutting room watching it again and again as we're trying to, decide each cut and we're talking to each other. And the fact is, it really entertains.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It's not, definitely does. It's one of the movies, why didn't I see this earlier? Mm-hmm. It would have been one of my favorites.
It's not like there's a lull and you wait for anything to happen. There's always something happening.
Yeah. That's eighties horror movies, especially horror comedies, are really good about that. So, anything you're working on now you want to talk about?
Well, at the moment, for at least a little while, I'm dealing with the repercussions of the Spookies re-release.
Yeah.
I have never been very much a fan of Facebook, for instance, and I've been told, you need to talk to the people on Facebook.
Yeah.
So I'm now garnering followers and and stalkers or whatever. And I've sort of learned, and I'm still learning how to navigate, but I do have to say it's very gratifying, and it makes me want to do movies again.
That's great.
But Tom, who was one of my partners, was the three of us, myself, Tom, and Brendan Faulkner, had a falling out after Spookies, and we sort of didn't remain close friends, and we maybe communicated occasionally if there was some business concerning the film. And then, back around the late 90s, I suddenly hear from Tom, and he said, look, whatever happened, I'm really sorry. Please, I apologize. I'd really like to work with you again. And I was like, wow, that's great. That's terrific. And so we started, again, he was in L.A., and we just started a long-distance partnership again. And because Tom was like a fountain of ideas. He would come up with a new idea every day, like a good idea, like one that I'd say, wow, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, that's a movie I want to see.
And he wrote some very excellent scripts. He was also an artist in several mediums. He would write something, he would design for it, he would... He passed away, unfortunately, just a few years ago. And at that time, he was in the midst of putting things together for a project we were hoping to do together that I wanted to produce, called Christy Cleek, which is based on an old Scottish, supposedly true legend. And he was like, he would not only be writing, he would be designing everything, every character, every costume, props, sets. He was drawing all this stuff. He then started making each individual prop himself. So, he was essentially like hand-making this whole film on his own.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a situation where, all right, if this takes months or years or whatever, I even if I have no one to help me and no money, I have to keep working towards this.
Oh, yeah, I totally understand that, too.
So, and unfortunately, that did not happen. I'd like to think maybe it still might someday. We had a project. We had a new project every few weeks or months, meaning that we'd put something together. We try to get it out there, talk to people, try and raise money.
Yeah.
And circumstances frequently change. It's like, oh, this is one moment a certain thing is the advantageous way to go, and you have a chance of, you think of maybe attracting some attention,
yeah.
And then maybe something else comes up. Somebody says, oh, hey, I like this thing you wrote 5 years ago, and da da da, and
yeah.
Then you go in that direction. And this resulted, unfortunately, over the years to, just a lot of just basically a lot of ventures fizzled out.
Yeah, yeah.
We came really close again and again. At one point, he had another Scottish true horror story on the legend of Sonny Bean, which many people have heard of. The movie, Wes Craven's movie, The Hills Have Eyes, is based on that story.
Yeah.
An updated version. But he had somebody he was speaking with over in Europe who was extremely interested, and just as he was about to get contracts, it suddenly came, and after making clear, all right, if you want my script, if you want to make this movie, you have to make me the director. That's the only way this will happen. And fine. And at the last moment, he was told, well, I've been talking to people, and they say we need a hot young director.
Oh.
And. And I said, well, if they need a hot young director, where is his hot young script?
Yeah.
So that just didn't happen. It's a shame. I mean, of course, it's like, but you keep, so you ride this roller coaster and you remain, after a certain number of years, extremely cynical about everything all the time.
I'm just reading about the business over my life.
Right. But you always still arrive at that point where you think, all right, maybe this time it's really going to happen.
Yeah.
And then, you allow yourself to become happy for a moment or two, and then, lightning hits you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that happen with a lot of people are just like, maybe finally it gets done, or just they just never, just always seem to be, stuck in development hell. Yeah.
Yeah, so, so we worked on lots of things. I have a backlog of scripts and ideas and treatments and outlines and things of my own, and I have the stuff Tom and I collaborated on, and he I haven't even gone through all the stuff that he sent me beyond all the stuff that's still in his own files. I mean, I think you could base a studio on his output of work.
Yeah, from sounds. Alrighty. Got anything else you want to say?
Yeah. Well, we're now in a position where people are actually aware of us and aware of Spookies. I think probably more people will become aware of the film than ever before. And so, in theory at least, we'll see, we're in a position to start talking to people about maybe doing a next film.
Yeah, and that'd be great. I know you talk about, maybe even an idea for Spookies.
Well, yeah, the original title of Spookies was Twisted Souls, so we've been talking about, if we did a sequel, it would be called Twisted Souls 2, even though there wasn't a Twisted Souls 1.
Technically
it
was.
And that it would probably have to be an outright horror comedy, intentionally, as opposed to something that became a comedy after people turned it into something else. It was defacing somebody and then putting a clown hat on them.
Oh, yeah. It was one of the scripts I've read of your Strong Arm Man, that's another movie. I was like, oh, wow, I would have loved this if it had gotten made.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think, we only wanted to make movies we could be proud of. We sort of were interested in doing things that met at the intersection of art and maybe exploitation or whatever, and that we liked a lot of genre-type films. But we liked the ones...
As years have gone on, people realize that's a thinner line.
Well, it's like... Ultimately, as some people have already said, all movies are exploitation movies. Yeah. They're selling themselves based on something, one thing or another. I think the thing is, as a filmmaker, you want to entertain, and that's I think half of the formula. But I think if you care, you want to try and put something a little more worthwhile into it, so that they won't forget that entertainment a day later.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody will stick with you, even if it's just that was really fun or really affecting.
And so at the moment, I'm actually I'm reviewing Tom and I. A few years before he passed away, had talked about many, many things, including a possible spooky sequel. At that time, we were trying to find out if we could actually get the rights to the film itself and release a DVD in the U.S.
Yeah.
Right, but that was a long, fruitless road that's that story's fit for another broadcast. But we talked about it, and then he like spontaneously wrote like a short outline, like mostly his work. And I remember looking at it then and thinking, wow, this could actually be good. I like this. As opposed to what sequel. Spookies, we were told what to write, more or less. So I dug that up again, and after, I sort of had to, be convinced that this was all actually happening now and that people were this excited about it. And so I'm working on a story treatment for Twisted Souls 2.
Yeah, it's great. And what you told me about it, sounds, very interesting.
I think it could be wonderful if we had a chance to do what I'm thinking and what I'm thinking and Tom's
even half the scale of what you were talking about would be
Tom's wife is involved and helping us, and I think we will probably get a couple of members of the original cast into it somewhere. My fantasy at this point is now that we can approach all the original effects people and other ones and get them all to do creatures again.
We'll
see.
Yeah, to provide some continuity.
So I'm and at the moment, with Spookies, it was like you had to write a movie and our budget was supposedly $250,000. We did go over budget, but we had a lot of restrictions.
Yeah.
So this time I'm just sort of writing it. I'm not worrying about the budget.
Yeah. It's like they always say, you go big and you scale it back.
Right. So I'm literally prepared to I want to walk into people's offices and say, all right, we have this $80 million spooky sequel.
Who do you think you are, James Wan? But that's like you said, you start big and you go from there, go big or go home. And it sounds like a really cool idea.
Because something comes of all this. I think that if Tom and Brendan and I had been allowed to, if we'd had some small success at the time with the movies in the first place, we would have had a lot more opportunity. We would have been able to see our dreams realized to a greater extent.
What I talked about, I was like, I'm surprised, it didn't even happen a little bit, because the market was always starving and it still is. So
it is, and right now, as you know, there's so much horror stuff out there. On the streaming and video markets, it's insane. Literally hundreds of these ultra cheapy movies are coming out, and it's really hard to know which ones might or might not be worthwhile. It's not like it's like you have to really go around the internet, scour for reviews and information to find out about something, and at the same time most of them are just not worth the time spent watching them.
Well, all right. Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Frank. And
hey, my pleasure, of course.
Great to have you, and may have you on again. And hope something good comes out of this. I think the re-release is currently sold out, but maybe Vinegar Syndrome.
Yeah, I encourage everybody go out. Don't go out because you have to stay at home and go online. Go online and go to the Vinegar Syndrome page, or go to the Spookies Facebook fan page.
Yeah.
Or go to my fan page. Go to my page, Frank Farrell, F-A-R-E-L, and you'll get the latest updates and information on Spookies, a lot of which I'm just recently learning and sort of blowing the fans of minds and my own.
I've been following that.
But, I welcome everyone to take a look at the movie and judge for themselves, but to also know what happened to this movie and to watch the documentary by Glenn Baisley and Michael Gingold, who did a great job of trying to make this story clear to the movie world. Finally,
the story is told.
Well, there will always be more to this story, apparently.
Keeps getting dug up.
It's full speed ahead now.
Great, that's great. Thank you for coming, and that's it for Forgotten Geek until the first Tuesday of January. Be back, and appropriately enough, I will be going out today with from the Star Wars Holiday Special. B. Arthur, probably the only good thing about it. B. Arthur saying good night, but not goodbye.
Just one more round, friend, then homeward bound, friend. Don't forget me in your dreams.
Just one more song, friend, and then so long, friend. The nights get shorter, it seems. Just one more rhyme, friend. Yes, it's a crime, friend, but you know time, friend. Time can fly. So it's good night, friend. Good night, but not goodbye. Just one more drop, friend, before we stop, friend.